Hello, listeners. If you are enjoying this podcast without commercial interruption and are financially able, please consider supporting our effort. To contribute, go to the homepage, spacerockethistory.com, and click on the orange donate button or the Patreon link. Or you can donate on Venmo or Zelle using my email address, spacerockethistory@gmail.com. Thanks.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Godspeed, John Glenn.
Roger, zero G, and I feel fine.
Can I feel out? Okay, I'm out.
How does it feel for the United States to be the new record holder?
At last, huh?
When that baby lights, there's no doubt about it.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Hello and welcome. This is Michael Annis, and you're listening to episode number 436 of the Space Rocket History Podcast. This episode is dedicated to Brody Hall, a listener to this podcast, along with his father. Sadly, Brody passed away about 2 weeks ago. He had 2 months left at a prep school before he graduated and went to the Naval Academy class of 2028. He wanted to fly F-18s. Brody Hall was 18 years old. And now, Pioneer 11.
They used to be called heavenly bodies. Our local star, prime mover of the earthly environment, father of all life. Our almost twin satellite, phasing predictably through the night. Small wonder both were regarded as gods by the ancients. Today we know the moon as a place. Now picture, if you will, a fantastic world where not one, but 12 moons crisscross the sky, 4 of them moving backwards, 4 others the size of small planets. This is Jupiter, largest member by far of the Sun's family, monarch of the outer planets, 1,000 times the size of Earth. In fact, twice as large as all the other planets combined. It is nearly a small star, a second sun. Jupiter, named for the Roman god of gods. To our eyes, it reveals only its dazzling cloud tops, rivers of wild color, and its trademark, the Great Red Spot, a perpetual storm of unknown origin. On Jupiter, day and night are each less than 5 Earth hours long, and a man would weigh 500 pounds. In early 1972, mankind launched Pioneer 10, the first mission to the outer planets, the first to venture out beyond the orbit of Mars, out through the Jupiter system, and eventually, out of our solar system completely. Share now the Odyssey of the Jupiter Pioneers. The planets of our solar system come in 2 varieties. The inner 4, including Earth, are heavy, rocky cinders. Where the 5th should be, there's only a band of debris, the asteroid belt. Beyond ride the enormous outer four, the mysterious gas giants. Astronomers have studied them since the time of Galileo. It was he who discovered Jupiter's four large moons with his newly perfected telescope. Beautiful ringed Saturn. In 1979, Pioneer 11 will make mankind's first visit to Saturn. If it survives the rigorous journey of 6 years in time, nearly 2 billion miles in distance.
2 years ago, I covered Pioneer 10 on episode 384. This episode will concentrate on its twin sister, Pioneer 11. In the 1960s, American aerospace engineer Gary Flandreau of the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory conceived of a mission known as the Planetary Grand Tour that would exploit a rare alignment of outer planets of the solar system. This mission would ultimately be accomplished in the late 1970s by the two Voyager probes. But in order to prepare for it, NASA decided in 1964 to experiment with launching a pair of probes to the outer solar system. An advocacy group named the Outer Space Panel and chaired by American scientist James A. Van Allen worked out the scientific rationale for exploring the outer planets. NASA Goddard Space Flight Center put together a proposal for a pair of galactic Jupiter probes that would pass through the asteroid belt and visit Jupiter. These were to be launched in 1972 and 1973. During favorable windows that occurred only a few weeks every 13 months. Launch during other time intervals would have been more costly in terms of propellant requirements. Approved by NASA in February 1969, the twin spacecraft were designated Pioneer F and Pioneer G before launch. Later, they were named Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11, respectively. They formed part of the Pioneer program, a series of United States uncrewed space missions launched between 1958 and 1978. This model was the first in the series to be designed for exploring the outer solar system. Based on proposals issued throughout the 1960s, the early mission objectives were to explore the interplanetary medium past the orbit of Mars, studying the asteroid belt, and assess the possible hazard to spacecraft traveling through the belt, and explore Jupiter and its environment. Later development stage objectives included the probe closely approaching Jupiter to provide data on the effect the environmental radiation surrounding Jupiter would have on the spacecraft instruments. More than 150 scientific experiments were proposed for the missions. The experiments to be carried out on the spacecraft were selected in a series of planning sessions during the 1960s, then were finalized by early 1970. These would be to perform imaging and polarimetry of Jupiter and several of its satellites, make infrared and ultraviolet observations of Jupiter, detect asteroids and meteoroids, determine the composition of charged particles, and to measure magnetic fields, plasma, cosmic rays, and the zodiacal light. Observation of the spacecraft communications as it passed behind Jupiter would allow measurements of the planetary atmosphere, while tracking data would improve estimates of the mass of Jupiter and its moons. NASA Ames Research Center, rather than Goddard, was selected to manage the project as part of the Pioneer program. The Ames Research Center, under the direction of Charles F. Hall, was chosen because of its previous experience with spin-stabilized spacecraft. The requirement called for a small, lightweight spacecraft which was magnetically clean and which could perform an interplanetary mission. It was to use spacecraft modules that had already been proven in the Pioneer 6 through 9 missions. Ames commissioned a documentary film by George Van Valkenburg titled Jupiter Odyssey. It received numerous international awards and is visible on Van Valkenburg's YouTube channel. In February 1970, Ames awarded a combined U.S. $380 million contract to TRW Incorporated for building both of the Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11 vehicles, bypassing the usual bidding process to save time. B.J. O'Brien and Herb Lassen led the TRW team that assembled the spacecraft. Design and construction of the spacecraft required an estimated 25 million man-hours. An engineer from TRW said this spacecraft was guaranteed for 2 years of interplanetary flight. If any component fails within that warranty period, just return a spacecraft to our shop and we will repair it free of charge. End quote. To meet the schedule, the first launch would need to take place between February 29th and March 17th so that it could arrive at Jupiter in November 1974. This was later revised to an arrival date of December 1973 in order to avoid conflicts with other missions over the use of Deep Space Network for communications, and to miss the period when Earth and Jupiter would be at opposite sides of the Sun. The encounter trajectory for Pioneer 10 was selected to maximize the information returned about the radiation environment around Jupiter. Even if this caused damage to some systems, it would come within about 3 times the radius of the planet, which was thought to be the closest it could approach and still survive the radiation. The trajectory chosen would give the spacecraft a good view of the sunlit side. Now let's talk about the spacecraft design. As I mentioned, Pioneer 10 and 11 were identical twins. Each had a bus that measured 36 centimeters or 14 inches deep with 6 76 centimeter long panels, that's 30 inches, forming the hexagonal structure. The bus houses propellant to control the orientation of the probe and 8 of the 11 scientific instruments. The equipment compartment lay within an aluminum honeycomb structure to provide protection from meteoroids. A layer of insulation consisting of aluminized mylar and Kapton blankets provides passive thermal control. Heat was generated by the dissipation of 70 to 120 watts from the electrical components inside the compartment. The heat range was maintained within the operating limits of the equipment by means of louvers located below the mounting platform. The spacecraft had a launch mass of about 260 kilograms or 570 pounds. At launch, the spacecraft carried 36 kilograms, 79 pounds, of liquid hydrazine monopropellant in a 42 centimeter or 17 inch diameter spherical tank. Orientation of the spacecraft was maintained with 6 4.5 Newton hydrazine thrusters mounted in 3 pairs. Pair 1 maintained a constant spin rate of 4.8 RPMs. Pair 2 controlled the forward thrust, and pair 3 controlled the attitude. The attitude pair were used in conical scanning maneuvers to track Earth in its orbit. Orientation information was also provided by a star sensor able to reference Canopus and 2 sun sensors. Now, power and communications. Pioneer 11 used 4 SNAP-19 radioisotope thermoelectric generators, or RTGs. In other words, it was a nuclear battery. They were positioned on 2 3-rod trusses, each 3 meters or 9.8 feet in length and 120 degrees apart. This was expected to be a safe distance from the sensitive scientific instruments carried on board. Combined, the RTGs provided 155 watts at launch and decayed to 140 watts in transit to Jupiter. The spacecraft required 100 watts to power all systems. The generators were powered by the radioisotope fuel plutonium-238, which is housed in a multi-layer capsule protected by a graphite heat shield, somewhat reminiscent of the Apollo ALSEP. The pre-launch requirement for the SNAP-19 was to provide power for 2 years in space. This was greatly exceeded during the mission. The plutonium-238 has a half-life of 87.74 years, so that after 29 years of radiation being generated by the RTGs was at 80% of its intensity from launch. However, steady deterioration of the thermocouple junctions led to more rapid decay in electrical power generation. And by 2001, the total power output was 65 watts. As a result, later in the mission, only selected instruments could be operated at any one time. The space probe included a redundant system of transceivers, one attached to the narrow-beam high-gain antenna, the other to an omni-antenna and medium-gain antenna. The parabolic dish for the high-gain antenna was 2.74 meters or 9 feet in diameter and made from an aluminum honeycomb sandwich material. The spacecraft was spun about an axis that was parallel to the axis of this antenna so that it could remain oriented toward the Earth. Each transceiver was an 8-watt one and transmitted data across the S-band using 2,110 megahertz for the uplink from Earth and 2,292 megahertz for the downlink to Earth, with the deep space network tracking the signal. Data to be transmitted was passed through a convolutional encoder so that the most communication errors could be corrected by the receiving equipment on Earth. The data transmission rate at launch was 256 bits per second, with the rate degrading by about 1.27 millibits for each day during the mission. Much of the computation for this mission was performed on Earth and transmitted to the spacecraft, where it was able to retain in memory up to 5 commands of the 222 possible entries by ground controllers. The spacecraft included 2 command decoders and a command distribution unit, a very limited form of a processor to direct operations on the spacecraft. This system required that mission operators prepare commands long in advance of transmitting them to the probe. A data storage unit was included to record up to 6,144 bytes of information gathered by the instruments. The digital telemetry unit was used to prepare the collected data in one of the 13 possible formats before transmitting it back to Earth. Now let's move on to the instrumentation carried aboard Pioneer 11.
The 11 onboard sensors include 5 radiation and charged particle detectors, 1 magnetometer, and 3 light measuring devices, 1 for the visible spectrum and 1 for either end of the visible range, the infrared and the ultraviolet. There's also an experiment to look for asteroids and 1 to measure the number of times Pioneer is struck by space dust.
have a few quick details on those 11 instruments that Pioneer 11 carried. First, the helium vector magnetometer. This instrument measured the fine structure of the interplanetary magnetic field. It mapped the Jovian magnetic field and provided magnetic field measurements to evaluate solar wind interaction with Jupiter. The magnetometer consists of a helium field cell mounted on a 6.6 meter boom to partly isolate the instrument from the spacecraft's magnetic field. The quadrospherical plasma analyzer peered through a hole in the large dish-shaped antenna to detect particles of the solar wind originating from the sun. There was a charged particle instrument that detected cosmic rays in a solar system. There was a cosmic ray telescope that was to collect data on the composition of the cosmic ray particles and their energy ranges. There was a Geiger tube telescope, and that was to survey the intensities, energy spectra, and angular distributions of electrons and protons along the spacecraft's path through the radiation belts of Jupiter. Next was the trapped radiation detector. This included an unfocused Cherenkov counter that detected the light emitted in a particular direction as particles passed through it, recording electrons of energy of 0.5 to 12 MeVs. An electron scatter detector for electrons of energy 100 to 400 keVs, and a minimum ionizing detector consisting of a solid-state diode that measured minimum ionizing particles less than 3 MeV, and protons in the range of 50 to 350 MeV. Meteoroid detectors. 12 panels of pressurized cell detectors mounted on the back of the main dish antenna recorded penetrating impacts of small meteoroids. An asteroid meteoroid detector was also included. It allowed a look into space with four non-imaging telescopes to track particles ranging from close by bits of dust to distant large asteroids. There was an ultraviolet photometer. The ultraviolet light was sensed to determine the quantities of hydrogen and helium in space and on Jupiter. There was an imaging photopolarimeter. The imaging instrument relied upon the spin of the spacecraft to sweep a small telescope across the planet in narrow strips, only 0.03 degrees wide, looking at the planet in red and blue light. These strips were then processed to build up a visual image of the planet. And lastly, there was an infrared radiometer, which provided information on cloud temperature and the output of heat from Jupiter. The final thing I want to discuss before launch is the carrier vehicle for Pioneer 11. It was the Atlas Centaur, a U.S. expendable launch vehicle derived from the SM-65 Atlas D missile. The vehicle featured a Centaur upper stage, the first such stage to use high-performance liquid hydrogen as fuel. Launches were conducted from Launch Complex 36 at the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. After a strenuous flight test program, Atlas Centaur went on to launch several crucial spaceflight missions for the United States, including Surveyor 1, Mariner 4, and of course Pioneer 10 and 11. The vehicle would be continuously developed and improved into the 1990s, with the last direct descendant being the highly successful Atlas II. In total, this vehicle launched 197 times, with 181 successes, 13 failures, and 3 partial failures. The first flight was way back on May 8, 1962, and the last flight for this carrier rocket was August 31, 2004. Of course, Pioneer 10 and 11 were designed as the first type of spacecraft to venture through the asteroid belt and explore the outer solar system. Pioneer 10 launched 13 months ahead of Pioneer 11 on March 3, 1972. In fact, mission planners originally conceived Pioneer 11 as a backup to Pioneer 10, in case there was a problem with Pioneer 10. NASA was particularly concerned about passing through the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. But by the time it came to launch Pioneer 11, Pioneer 10 had made it through the asteroid belt, and NASA's concerns seemed to be a little overblown. Pioneer 10 went on to become the first space probe to reach the planet Jupiter, while Pioneer 11 became the first probe to fly by Saturn. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I think it's now time to light this candle. On April 6, 1973, Pioneer 11 launched from Launch Complex 36A at Cape Canaveral, Florida, aboard an Atlas Centaur launch vehicle with a Star 37E propulsion module to provide the required velocity to send the spacecraft on a direct trajectory to Jupiter. This is the actual recording of the launch. There's also a more dramatized version from Van Valkenburgh's film.
13 months later, a sister spacecraft, Pioneer 11, left the pad on its long and chancy voyage to Jupiter and Saturn. It's not easy to break out of the solar system. It requires enough speed to defeat the sun's gravity as well as Earth's gravity. Pioneer streaks away faster than any previous spacecraft, gulping distance at 1,000,000 miles a day, passing the moon in just 11 hours. Still, Jupiter is nearly 2 years away.
By mid-March 1974, it was time to enter the asteroid belt.
The asteroid belt, as some had imagined it. Before Pioneer 10, it was pictured as a region where great boulders grind together, creating a 40,000-mile-per-hour sandstorm. If so, it might have represented a perpetual barrier to outer planet flights. In fact, the pioneers found very little space dust in the asteroid belt. True, there are several thousand asteroids, some as big as Texas, but they should offer no menace to navigation.
Pioneer 11 completed its crossing of the asteroid belt in April of 1974 without damage. In April of 1974, Pioneer 11 performed a course correction. This would guide it much closer to Jupiter than Pioneer 10 and ensure a polar flyby. In May of 74, it performed a 42-minute mid-course correction to enable the gravity assist maneuver to Saturn. Throughout its interplanetary journey, Pioneer 11 returned data to Earth about the solar wind, cosmic rays, and micrometeoroids. Pioneer 11 penetrated the Jovian bow shock on November 25, 1974. Now, the bow shock is the shock wave formed by the collision of a stellar wind with another medium, such as a magnetosphere of a planet. The Pioneer 11's closest approach to Jupiter occurred on December 3, 1974, at a range of about 26,400 miles or 42,500 kilometers from the planet's cloud tops. That is three times closer than Pioneer 10. By this time, it was traveling faster than any human-made object, more than 106,000 miles per hour. That's 171,000 kilometers per hour. Because of its high speed during the encounter with Jupiter, the spacecraft's exposure to Jupiter's radiation belts spanned a shorter time than its predecessor, Pioneer 10. Although it was actually closer to the planet. Pioneer 11 repeatedly crossed Jupiter's bow shock, indicating that the Jovian magnetosphere changed its boundaries as it is buffeted by the solar wind. Besides the many images of the planet and better pictures of the Great Red Spot, taken from a distance of 338,700 miles, Pioneer 11 took about 200 images of the planet's four largest moons, Ganymede, Callisto, Io, and Europa. Unlike Pioneer 10, which flew along Jupiter's equatorial plane, Pioneer 11 followed a more south-to-north trajectory. After passing behind the planet, Pioneer 11 re-emerged over Jupiter's north pole and returned the first images of that region of the planet, revealing that the equatorial atmospheric bands gave way at higher latitudes to more complex circulation patterns filled with vortices and individual storm systems. Pioneer 11 continued its observations of Jupiter until January 1, 1975. Then the mission planners retargeted Pioneer 11 to use the giant planet's gravity to slingshot the spacecraft across the solar system to explore Saturn. The decision carried a certain amount of risk, as this gravity assist maneuver required Pioneer 11 to pass much closer to Jupiter than its predecessor. But the unique trajectory enabled Pioneer 11 to image Jupiter's previously unexplored polar regions. After Pioneer 11's Jupiter encounter, on April 16, 1975, the micrometeoroid detector was turned off since it was issuing spurious commands, which were interfering with other instruments. Course corrections were made on May 26, 1976 and July 13, 1978 to sharpen its trajectory toward Saturn. Pioneer 11 detected Saturn's bow shock on August 31, 1979, about 932,000 miles, 1.5 million kilometers out from the planet, thus providing the first conclusive evidence of the existence of Saturn's magnetic field. The spacecraft crossed the planet's ring plane beyond the outer ring on September 1, 1979, and then passed by the planet at a close encounter range of about 13,000 miles or 20,900 kilometers. It was moving at a relative velocity of about 71,000 miles per hour or 114,000 kilometers per hour at the point of closest approach. During the encounter, the spacecraft took 440 images of the planetary system, with about 20 at a resolution of about 56 miles or 90 kilometers. The images of Saturn's moon Titan at a resolution of 112 miles or 180 kilometers showed a featureless orange fuzzy satellite. A brief burst of data on Titan indicated that the average global temperature of Titan was minus 315 degrees Fahrenheit, or minus 193 degrees Celsius. Among Pioneer's 11's many discoveries were a narrow ring outside of the A ring, named the F ring, and a new satellite, 124 miles or 200 kilometers in diameter. Spacecraft recorded the planet's overall temperature at minus 292 degrees Fahrenheit, that's minus 180 degrees Celsius, and photographs indicated a more featureless atmosphere than that of Jupiter. Analysis of data suggested that the planet was primarily made of liquid hydrogen. After leaving Saturn, Pioneer 11 headed out of the solar system in a direction out opposite to that of Pioneer 10, toward the center of the galaxy in the general direction of Sagittarius. Pioneer 11 crossed the orbit of Neptune on February 23, 1990, becoming the fourth spacecraft after Pioneer 10, Voyager 1 and 2, to do so. Scientists expect that during their outbound journeys, both Pioneer 10 and 11 will find the boundaries of the heliosphere where the solar winds slow down and form a termination shock, beyond which there would be the heliopause and finally the bow shock of the interstellar medium, the space beyond our solar system. The Pioneer 11 mission was only planned for 21 months of operations, just long enough to reach Jupiter and study the giant planet. Pioneer 11 ended up also making the first remote observations of Saturn and operating for more than 22 years after the encounter with the ringed planet. On February 23, 1990, Pioneer 11 passed the orbit of the outermost planet and began its interstellar mission. The final signal from the spacecraft was received on November 24, 1995, when it was more than 4 billion miles from Earth. Should an advanced alien civilization find either Pioneer spacecraft, each carried a plaque providing information about its creators and where it originated. Carl Sagan and Frank Drake designed the plaque, and Linda Salzman Sagan drew it. As of January 20th, 2023, Pioneer 11 is estimated to be 111.678 AUs, that would be 16.7 billion kilometers or 10.38 billion miles from the Earth, and 110.76 AUs, 16.57 billion kilometers, 10.29 billion miles from the Sun. It was traveling at 11,176 kilometers per second, or 40,230 kilometers per hour, or 25,000 miles per hour, relative to the Sun, and traveling outward at about 2.36 AU per year. In a mere 928,000 years, it will pass within a quarter parsec, or 0.82 light years, of the K-dwarf TYC9921921, and will pass near the star Lambda Aquilae in about 4 million years. Pioneer 11 has now been overtaken by the two Voyager probes launched in 1977, and Voyager 1 became the most distant object built by humans and will remain so for the foreseeable future, as no probe launched since Voyager has the speed to overtake it. Thank you. Salutations from the foothills of North Carolina on the shores of the mighty Yadkin River. This is Michael Annis, your host, and I wanted to say thanks for listening to episode number 436 of the Space Rocket History Podcast entitled Pioneer 11. Our next episode should be released on or about Saturday, April 20th. If you would like to be notified by email when new episodes are posted, you can subscribe to the blog by going to the homepage, spacerockethistory.com, and typing in your email in the text box or on that which is on the right side of the page. If you're looking for old episodes of the podcast, the first 255 are available on the archive podcast, the Space Rocket History Archive. That's what you have to search for if you'd like to find it. Be sure to follow me on Twitter, now called X. My handle is at Space Rocket Hist. And if you want, you can follow me on Facebook and Patreon as well by searching for Space Rocket History. Had a few afterthoughts. As always, I apologize for my mispronunciations. I dedicated this episode to Brody Hall, a young man with a promising career preparing to enter the Naval Academy, hopefully to fly F-18s. Well, Brody's father wrote me an email and told me that he and his son both enjoyed the podcast as they shared an interest in space rocket history. And sadly, Brody passed away a couple weeks ago. And he was only 18 years old, and you just don't expect things like that to happen. I know they do, but it's a real shock, and it really just broke my heart hearing about that. And he was a listener of the podcast, and his father was too, and I just felt like I wanted to recognize them in some way. So I dedicated this podcast to Brody. And hopefully it'll give his father some comfort. And of course, we do want to extend our deepest condolences from the Space Rocket History Podcast to Jeremy, Brody's father. Now, concerning the episode, as I mentioned, I did a similar episode for Pioneer 10. Of course, there were differences in the mission, but a lot of the goals were similar, and the spacecrafts were virtually identical. Those two Pioneer probes, 10 and 11, were sort of a test run for the big show, which was the Voyager probes. But wow, did they perform over a extremely long lifetime. They were thinking maybe a couple years we'll get these things. Those things last and last and last. As far as we know, I mean, we don't have contact with Pioneer 11 anymore, but as far as we know, it's still going out there, just headed out of the solar system. Now, you can't ask for much better performance than that out of a probe. I took a little time explaining the instrumentation on Pioneer 11, just so you would understand what NASA was looking for out there. And always remember, if you're not interested in all that techno babble, just feel free to fast forward over that part. It's not a problem. In fact, I don't even know that you do it. So I mean, it's not that big a deal. During my early life, I can remember the concern the scientists had over passing through the asteroid belt. But Pioneer 10 proved that it could be done with relative ease, and the conditions were not nearly as bad as they thought. I mean, before Pioneer 10, they thought this was going to be quite a treacherous thing, passing through the asteroid belt. But it turned out it wasn't, which is good. I was also impressed with the speed gain of the slingshot effect with Pioneer 11 passing 100,000 miles per hour on its way to Saturn. Boy, now that's some speed. That's about all I have on the episode. In personal news, I do have some bad news. My mother-in-law had a major setback earlier this week, and she became unresponsive, and we had to call 911 and get her to the hospital. After running a bunch of tests, the current diagnosis, and I say current because it seems to change daily, is she has an infection in her heart, which is very bad because she is still recovering from that valve replacement. So the infection is kind of attacking that valve, and that's not good at all. So right now, the prognosis for her is uncertain. I wish I could have delivered better news than that. Okay, let's move on. Over the past fortnight, we received 5 new donations and pledges for 2024. I would like to thank Mark C. from South Carolina, who donated at the Orion level and earned a rocket emoji. Ron F. donated at the Apollo level and earned a rocket emoji. Daniel S. from Bowling Green, Kentucky, donated at the Soyuz level and earned a galaxy emoji. Joe C. from Colorado donated at the Vostok level and earned a moon emoji. Tim R. from Georgia pledged on Patreon at Apollo and earned a shooting star emoji. Our Patreon donors went down for this month by 3. They're down to 219. Hopefully that's an expiration date problem, so if you wouldn't mind, check your expiration dates on your credit cards if you have a chance. Our total unique donors, which includes Patreon, PayPal, Venmo, Zelle, and checks for 2024, have reached 259, with a goal of reaching 400 for 2024. So if you're enjoying the podcast that's been running now for over 11 years without commercial interruptions, and you can't afford it, please consider going to the homepage at spacerockethistory.com and clicking on the orange donate button or the Patreon link, or you can donate by check. You can also donate on Venmo or Zelle by using my email address, spacerockethistory@gmail.com. And by the way, if you began the emoji maneuver last year, now's an excellent time to complete it. Today, I would like to give a shout out to all those who promoted to the galaxy emoji for 6 years of financial support. And they are Dallas K, Darth R, Alex B, Ian B, Brett M, Daniel M, Lyndon N, Jeanette and Mark W, Gary A, Brad, Stephen F, Florian G, Lowry H, Edward N, Andy P, Ooh, David S, Nicholas W, X15A2, Darren S, Alistair S, Amy G, Steve M, Daniel S, Ray F, Ian M, John M, Tim P, Devin W, David, Chris L, MW, and Greg Z. Thank you so much for 6 years of support. We sincerely appreciate it. All right. Let's move along, and I'll go ahead and do Mrs. SRH's part since she is taking care of her mother. The winner of this episode's choice of the SRH archive magnet or 2 stickers or NASA's meatball sticker. With the help of Google's random number generator, Mrs. SRH selected Lincoln John. Lincoln John, if you will email us at spacerockethistory@gmail.com to tell us your address and your SRH prize preference, we will get this out to you. Sincere thanks to all who contributed so far in 2024. My sources for this episode were NASA, Beyond Earth, A Chronicle of Deep Space Exploration by Asif A. Siddiqui. George Van Valkenburg's video, sponsored by NASA Ames Research Center. Britannica, the Internet Archive, Flickr, and Wikipedia. And that is it for this episode. We will try to have episode 437 posted on or about April 20th. So long for now.